This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Since Roe v. Wade fell, a network of activists has been putting medications used for at-home abortions into the hands of women who have lost the constitutional right to reproductive choice.
So they actually started calling themselves the Pill Fairies. And this is a collective of women who range in age from 30 to 82. And they each have a different role in this network.
Stephanie Atella-Dreed has been reporting for The New Yorker on abortion since well before the Dobbs decision. Steph, this is now the first time that we're hearing from women who are really doing this, sometimes at great personal risk. Where does it start? Who's coordinating this effort?
So the woman coordinating this is Veronica Cruz. She's a legendary activist based in Mexico, and she runs an organization called Las Libres, which means the free ones. She started Las Libres back in the early 2000s when abortion was criminalized in Mexico. It's since been decriminalized. And I've been talking with her about the model that she developed called acompañamiento. The idea is one person, the acompañante, brings pills along with tips about how to use them to women in need of abortion.
Y pues nada, de enero para acá hemos desarrollado cuatro estrategias, ¿no? La más solicitada son las mujeres que nos contactan y nosotras les colocamos las...
I met with Veronica in Guanajuato, her home state in central Mexico. That was in early August. And she told me how she first developed this model for women there who were sexual assault survivors. The idea was to make abortion not just more accessible for them, but less frightening. And now, she's extending that model over the border with the help of these pill fairies, this underground network of volunteers.
So, Steph, maybe it would be very helpful for you to walk us through how this whole system, this underground, as you describe it, works.
Right. So, immediately after Roe was overturned, a number of American women living in Mexico reached out to Veronica saying, we want to help. And there's a number of ways they can do this. The first step in the supply chain is obviously to get the medications. I talked with a group of elderly American women who are doing this. They live in San Miguel de Allende, a town close to where Veronica lives, and it has a large community of American expats, like these women. So when they started working with Veronica, they called dozens of pharmacies around town, trying to source the medications. Some of which, by the way, are available over-the-counter in Mexico. From there, the next step in the chain is to get the pills over the border. Some volunteers are driving the medications across. Some are packing them into their bags and flying into the States. And I'll tell you about one of the women I spoke with, whom I'll call Claire. She's been traveling to San Miguel de Allende for decades. And when she heard about Veronica's work, she decided, okay, I'm going to contribute to this cause. In August, when I traveled to San Miguel to meet with her, she took me to an artisanal market in town. It was early in the morning. We were walking through rows of stands selling all kinds of jewelry, hearts of blown glass, and portable shrines of the Virgin of Guadalupe. And she explained to me how she hides abortion pills using earrings that she buys from these local vendors.
So I should explain something at this point before we hear that. You met this woman and recorded your interview But the voice we're going to hear is another woman who's dubbed over the tape, an actor, because these people, the pill fairies, as you call them, don't want their voices used on the radio. And certainly in The New Yorker, they didn't want their names used either.
That's right. And that is because abortion is effectively banned in 14 states. And so these women risk going to prison, depending on where they're mailing the medications from, and facing a very, very steep fine. So this is Claire walking in the market.
When my parents brought me down here in 1971 for the summer, it felt like that was the most exciting thing that could have happened. It felt like all my childhood memories were in black and white, except for the summer we spent in San Miguel de Allende, which was Technicolor. So when I came back years later, I was reluctant to come back because I'd heard that, you know, so many Texans and gringos had ruined the place. But when I came back, I felt like it was still really magical. And so now I go back and forth to the States, and kind of makes me a perfect person to work with Los Libres because I have, you know, global entry, and I figured I might as well use my privilege and sneak into the country with some abortion pills.
She stopped at a booth where a young man was selling flower-shaped earrings. Each piece was made of colorful glass beads, and she bought 20 of them. They looked like sunflowers, camellias, and roses.
So I buy these little earrings here from these guys. First of all, I love their work. The earrings are beautiful, and they're kind of a sweet gift to give to somebody who is going through a hard time. You know, I want to be discreet about sending pills, and so, you know, I want to make it look like a little present or something like that. And so I was thinking, so I bought a bunch of jewelry boxes, you know, the kinds that are stuffed with cotton. And I thought between the layers of cotton is like a perfect place to put the pills with a little sheet of instructions. And then I put the earrings on top of that. And so, you know, it looks like you received a pair of earrings. And I think it's really important to be discreet because you don't know what a woman's situation is. Like maybe she's living alone, maybe she's living with, you know, a violent boyfriend or husband who would be really angry to know that she was getting pills. You know, I could just imagine someone opening it and saying, "What is this?" and throwing it out and having a fit and beating somebody up, you know. So I just wanted to make it as discreet as possible. But then also, I just kind of like the idea that, you know, it's just so stressful to be pregnant when you don't want to be. It's like you have all these hormones going and you don't like the way your body feels. You just want it to be over. And so I thought, you know, it'd be nice to get a pair of earrings when you're in that kind of mood.
Steph, this is someone you spoke with in a market in Mexico, and her role in this is to bring the pills used for abortions from Mexico to California. Then she does what?
So once she gets home, Veronica Cruz, who is the activist that we've been talking about, sends her the addresses of women in need of the medication. And she talked about the fact that when she started doing this, she was quite curious. And she started looking up the addresses online. And she found trailer homes and rundown apartments. And she kept thinking about the women who lived in those houses.
But these are women who make their needs known for abortion pills?
Yes. So they reach out to Veronica. They contact her via WhatsApp or Signal. Or they can also call Las Libres. And sometimes they'll just say hello, and Veronica will know what they're looking for. And then they'll give her their address. And the pills are free, so that's pretty much it.
I have to say, Steph, as I listen to you describe this operation, we've gone from legalized abortion, where there are all kinds of problems, of course, but there were systems in place. There were clinics, there were doctors, and now we were reduced to activists finding ways to put pills in boxes with earrings and hope for the best. It is extraordinary, the efforts they're going to, but it's devastating to listen to what these people are reduced to doing, to get what they need.
Right. And I think that one could argue that what we have in the country now are just different standards of care, right? Because, remember, there are states in the country where abortion is still legal. And so the women who have the means to travel to those states will be able to do that. And they'll be able to see a doctor, they'll be able to go to a clinic and receive the care that they need.
The poor get poorer.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm talking with Stephanie Teledreed. In a moment, we'll meet one of the volunteers who delivers pills in person at great legal risk. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Stephanie Teledreed has just published an ambitious piece of reporting in The New Yorker. It's about an underground network that delivers medications used in at-home abortions. 14 states have effectively banned abortion in this country. And the people who are part of this underground network are understandably cautious about speaking on the record. In our segment today, the women's recorded interviews with Stephanie were overdubbed in order to protect their anonymity. These women refer to themselves as pill fairies. Before the break, we heard from one of the women who carries the pills over the border from Mexico, where some of the medications are available over the counter. Now, remind us of what these pills are. What are the medications, and how do they do their work?
So we're talking about two sets of pills, mifepristone, which blocks progesterone, and misoprostol, which causes uterine contractions. These pills are not available over the counter in the States, right? In order to get them, you need to go to either an abortion clinic where a doctor will charge you upwards of $500 for the pills, and then you'll take them at home, or you can get them mailed to your house. This is obviously in states where the procedure is still legal, again, for hundreds of dollars.
Well, I have to ask you, is it safe to use these pills, and are they successful without the supervision of a doctor?
Very much so. I mean, the World Health Organization has explicitly stated that medication abortions don't need to be administered by a physician. The risk of running into complications is actually really, really low. Studies show that in less than 1% of the cases, women develop an infection or a hemorrhage.
So, Steph, are these medications all being distributed by mail from out of state? That's how these women are limiting their legal risk, right?
So not everyone mails a medication. You also have pill fairies who decide to meet the women in person and hand the medication directly to them. And I actually met a woman in Texas who has been doing this for several months now. She told me about her determination, her conviction, really, to make sure that women were not alone in this process, that she could accompany them. And I think it's important to point out, David, that most of the cases that this woman described were straightforward interactions. A majority of people picked up the medication and told her, "Thank you for the pills. I'll let you know if anything goes wrong." And then she never heard from them again.
Yeah, so many people. I guess like little vignettes is the easiest way to talk about it because they really are all so different.
But in some cases, some of the women were in situations that, to me, highlighted the need for abortion care, reproductive care, to be accessible and delivered by professionals.
One woman was in a super violent marriage, already has 3 children with this person, and has been looking for a way out. And when she realized she was pregnant, it felt like a death sentence to her. So I met her at a park. She was like shaking. She was really nervous. She didn't have a lot of time because her husband always knows where she is. Yeah, it was awful. It was terrible. Yeah.
How was that interaction with her?
I think it left me feeling like a little bit like hopeless, like both hopeful and hopeless somehow. It's like I felt good that, like, at the very least, this one thing she would have control over, and she'd be able to stop herself from, like, she'd have one less thing to worry about when she's trying to leave this person. So it just felt like one thing would go right. But I felt hopeless because that's not how she saw it. Yeah.
When you think about the people that you've helped, is there another case that stands up?
Yeah, the teenager stands out to me a lot.
Why is that?
Well, just that she was so innocent and, like, unaware, like, so in shock. Like, basically, she was very, very young, like, I think in 8th grade, and her grandmother came, and I think her aunt, there were 2 women with her. Like, the grandma was doing her best to be, like, kind, but was also just, like, you know, they were a little harsh on her. Like, I think they were, like, pissed that she got pregnant. So I was, like, I kept trying to talk to her directly, and, like, she was just clearly so in shock. Like, she wasn't absorbing the information. So I was just like, okay, let me talk to these other 2 people so that they know what's going on. But, like, that really made me, I just felt really out of my depth. Like, I felt really unprepared to counsel them in a meaningful way, and they clearly needed it. Like, whoever the younger woman was like, you know, like, she was speaking in Spanglish, like, Spanish and English. But I don't know exactly what she was saying, but I could, like, basically tell she was like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like, you are a child. How did we get here? That's one that sticks with me because it just feels like in other states or under a better law system, her grandmother could have taken her to a sexual reproductive health clinic where they could have had a conversation with her, taught her about condoms, given her resources, given her a phone number to call, given her birth control, and sent her home feeling empowered with more information. And instead, she had to go to some random person she's never met's house. I'm sure they did not feel safe or comfortable here. I just felt like I was able to meet one very specific need, but, like, I feel like they had a lot of needs that, like, me alone has, you know, no reference points or, like, qualifications or expertise to, like, support.
Steph, you interviewed this woman in Texas. In your story, you call her Anna. She's distributing abortion medication illegally, and the penalties for that are very high, or they can be. How concerned was she about taking this risk?
She was very concerned, but at the same time, she took as many precautions as she could. She rarely meets women at home. She almost always tells them to meet her at a public park or at a coffee place. And when she meets people at a park, she wears a mask, large sunglasses, and a sun hat. to, you know, really mask her identity.
I want to find out how to convey to my neighbors that this is available, and I'm scared to. I think in general I'm a trusting person, but when it's such a severe penalty, I just would want to be really careful.
Why did they want to talk with you then, Steph?
I think it's an act of resistance. And the way many of them have put it to me is they want other women to know in places where abortion has been banned, that they can still exercise that right. And that if they need an abortion, they don't need to go through a back alley procedure. They can reach out to someone who has the tools to get one, who is well informed about how to do so, and who will not put their health at risk in any way.
Were you able to talk with anyone who actually received pills in this system?
I actually did. This a woman named Sarah, who was already a mother and for financial reasons could not have a second child. And she learned of her pregnancy and she, in a panic, started reaching out to some of her friends who she knew would be able to help her.
My friend asked me, are you looking for, you know, like a clinical solution? Because at that time, that was still a possibility. Clinical pills, managing it yourself, or going to a doctor or whatever. And I was like, self-managed because I don't, well, the laws are about to change and I can't risk having that on the books. And so she said, okay. She said, here's some websites that you can get information from and order from. And here's, she was like, I might have a local contact too. Just give me a few minutes. And I was like, okay. And so I went through two processes. I went through one of the websites. That's where you like fill out a form. That's a Teladoc appointment. And then they send it to a pharmacy in India. And then they mail order it, which did cost money. So I did that process, but then my friend texted me back and put me in touch with Anna.
That's the pill fairy in Texas that we heard from earlier.
And Anna said, can I help you or whatever? And I said, well, I'm hoping that I can find something local. And she said, well, I'm here until 12:30. And so she explained the program to me, that they're essentially smuggling pills to Texan women. And so she gave me instructions. If this, you need to go to the hospital. And I was like, great. I had a positive test at 9:30 in the morning, and I was pills in my purse driving home by 11:30 in the morning.
Wow, that's incredible. Did the other pills ever arrive?
They did. I think about 2 weeks later, so it was still really early. And I just have them on hand so that I can be a pill fairy to someone in need if necessary. I have referred, I think, two other people to Anna, but if she were not able to help or if somebody didn't want to go to someone else, I would do the same thing.
The way she explained this to me, she was actually tucking the pills in her dresser drawer when she realized that nothing but her fears stood in the way of her doing what Anna had done for her. And so she picked up her phone, texted Anna and said, hey, how do I start doing what you do?
I mean, there's nothing else to do, right? Like, you can't just lie down and accept it. You can't, right?
Steph, this really raises an essential question, and that's where all this is going. Do you see these kinds of networks growing, or will they get cracked down upon by the states that are so aggressively against abortion? Or are these networks going to shrivel as we get increasingly harsher punishments in some areas?
I think if you were to ask Veronica, she would tell you that the bigger the movement becomes, the harder it'll be to crack down on, right? It's a decentralized system. It's not as easy as turning to an abortion provider, an abortion clinic, and saying, you know, that's it. I take away your license. You cannot operate in the state anymore. It's women taking matters into their own hands in a safe manner, right?
But they're taking matters into their own hands at a moment when the surveillance state has extraordinary technology to figure out digital footprints, to figure out your Google search data, all that can be accessed for possible prosecution. Is it really possible for networks like this to keep on working successfully?
I think it is. Most of the women I talk to are communicating through Signal, which is an encrypted app. And they're very conscious of digital surveillance. But there's also the question of how far prosecutors will actually go to prosecute these women. Many of these laws restricting abortions are so new, we really haven't seen them play out. And you know, the politics of enforcing these penalties is complex. If we look at Texas, for instance, there was a survey that came out last month that found that 60% of voters actually favored abortion being available in all or most cases. Only 10% supported banning abortions completely. So in this context, as one lawyer put it to me, it seems conservative lawmakers would benefit just as much from pretending that no abortions are happening as they would from prosecuting them.
Steph, your reporting here is extraordinary and goes to the heart of the results of a Supreme Court decision, and I thank you for bringing it to us.
Thank you, David.
You can read the post Roe Abortion Underground by Stephania Talladreed at NewYorker.com. The interviews with volunteers we heard were overdubbed to protect the identity of our sources. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Some of you may be familiar with a novelist called Arthur Less, a minor American novelist, to be precise. He's the hero of Andrew Sean Greer's novel called Less. He's a man whose biggest talent seems to be taking a problem and making it five times worse. Less was a bestseller and won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction, which is pretty rare for a book as funny as Less. In Andrew Sean Greer's sequel, Less is Lost, Arthur Less has now fallen on hard times, and so he takes on a series of gigs to make ends meet, which turns into a kind of road trip across the United States.
It was right after the 2016 presidential election, and I just thought, oh, there's something I don't understand. Let me go right into that. because my family is from the South, and I thought, I don't understand where my family's from. Apparently, the challenge was this time not how to write joy on the page, but to how to write about my country, honestly. That was what was constantly in my mind.
Andrew Sean Greer just talked with our staff writer, Parle Sagel.
One of the things I love about talking about Less and Less is Lost with other readers is this shy expression kind of takes over their faces and they'll just say how much they enjoyed it, as if pleasure is this subversive feeling that we've forgotten we can get this from literary fiction. But I, you know, as I was reading this, I was like, why don't I read more books like this? Why do I laugh so infrequently when I'm reading books? What is it about the comic novel? Why don't we see more of them? Why do they feel so rare?
I mean, that's a tough question because when people ask me my influences, I end up saying, like, actually, I only have a couple comic novels that I really love. And I think, well, I think I thought I needed to be a serious writer. It's a sin. You know, it's sinful. We're supposed to be learning something important through serious thought, not through someone's manipulation of our sense of humor and taking us across it. And yet I know that some of my favorite books, the ones I hold dear and reread, are like Graham Greene's Entertainments. I don't reread his colonial adventure books. I reread Travels with My Aunt.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we also have to be conscious of ourselves as learning. And it's such a shame because, you know, when I think about the comic novel and the comic novel as you are writing them, you know, they're a fantastic cover. Charm is a terrific cover for all kinds of things that one can do and that you are up to, you know? And one of the things that struck me as I was reading Less is Lost is how interested he becomes in his journey in his own whiteness. And it becomes a book about whiteness, which I don't think I've seen reviews pick up on, in fact.
I thought a lot about it. Like, okay, I'm writing a book about like a white gay guy going through the South. What I don't want to have is the road trip story where he goes to like a black church and comes to understanding about race. Like, that's wildly offensive. What I'm going to do is treat each side person as a real person. You can't just have someone walk in and pour coffee and walk out, and that they only have like a beehive hairdo and funny glasses. Like, that's not moral, you know, like in some strange way. I was like, that you have to spend time to make that a real person.
I mean, to go to the idea of comedy and charm sort of being, they can be a bit of a cover. I was thinking about, you know, you're following up your Pulitzer Prize winning book Less with Less is Lost. And there's so much to enjoy and love about these books that are about love, but they're also, you know, positioning themselves as a story about America, you know? I want to hear you talk a little bit more about that and more about what the novel can do when you're thinking about telling the story of a country, you know, that maybe an article can't do or an essay or a nonfiction book. Where can the novel take us?
Well, that was the challenge, is how do you talk about something so big and amorphous and that's changing underneath your feet? And luckily, I think a novelist can bring it to you, can first of all not answer it. And I feel like an article sometimes feels they have to come up with a thesis about it. I have a sort of Czech writer show up at the beginning of the book and say, Americans never ask themselves, what if the whole idea is wrong? And we don't. We just keep saying, how can we fix this? But what if it was a flawed from the beginning? And I don't have an answer to that. I just wanted to think about it as I did my trip and as I wrote about my trip and see whether a gay man could feel at home in these places where he's not supposed to be, whether anyone really feels at home in a country that's so vast. You surely feel out of home somewhere. And yeah. How we're going to hold together, which was also about the relationship between Arthur and Freddie, our narrator, whether they can hold together.
I think that notion of how to persist without answers is so central to the book, both in the sense of, you know, the American experiment, but also, I mean, this is profoundly a book about middle age and, right? And about this relationship whose code word is uncertain and uncertainty, right? So how do you persist without scripts and without answers? And I think this brings me to some of the scenes that I found most moving in this book that I feel like I actually haven't seen. I'm sure they exist elsewhere in novels, but I certainly haven't seen them enough. And that's
conversations between different generations of gay men. And that, to me, I was like, this is different, right? Because there's, you know, Freddie's of a certain age, Arthur's a bit older, and then there's Arthur's lover who's passed away. And you see three different lives or three different sets of questions, three different sets of fears, anxieties. Tell me about staging these kinds of conversations and this kind of relationship. Was it a conscious aim?
That was the setup that I got to bring with me from Les, because it interested me to have a character who'd been the younger lover suddenly get older and become the older lover. And then I realized I had set up three different generations of gay men, and I am very aware of those completely different approaches to life. I hear my generation of men in their around 50 expressing displeasure at watching younger gay men. And often what it is that there's an envy at the freedom that we fought for and that they take for granted. But we also have to realize there's another generation older than us that went through things we can't even imagine, and we should be grateful. And sometimes in the internet you see I'm referred to as a queer elder, which is an honor, but I just hadn't thought of myself that way yet, and I have to prepare for that. That's where I'm going, and there is some respect, but then there's often a frustration. For instance, that in my generation, we often think of ourselves as not being people of privilege because we lived through the AIDS pandemic and getting beat up and no one being out, and yet we have now, if we look at ourselves, we actually are creatures of privilege, and it is hard to make that shift, I think, a lot, and see what we need to change inside and also let other people into the rights that we have fought for and won, and not just bring the ladder up and say, like, all right, we're going to Fire Island, that's it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when you started writing this character, Arthur, he was older than you, and you've gotten older and closer in age to him. Do you relate to him differently?
I definitely do. Although he clearly, even the way I'm dressed today, I look exactly like the cover art.
Oh my God, you absolutely do.
Which I just did by accident.
And this is absurd.
Amazing. I definitely give him stories from my life and my deepest humiliations, and the story of his first kiss is exactly what my first kiss was like. But I don't think of him as me, because now I'm older than him. And I look at him more like a cousin of some kind who is more innocent than I and sweeter, but also blind and clumsy and causing pain to other people. And that's a nice position to be in as a novelist, because I have enough distance to deal with him as a different person. And I think I'd be more cruel to myself than I'm pretty cruel to him, I have to say. I put him in a hurricane.
You put him through a lot, but it's not punishing. It's loving, it's indulgent, it's all of these things, but his haplessness and Freddie's voice are the real engines of this book for me. I don't know if you've been paying attention to the sort of churning conversations. I mean, these conversations aren't new, but they seem to be picking up again in terms of queer literature about how to balance trauma and joy, right?
Yeah.
And what is the role of the novelist? What is the role of the novel in telling these stories? What is the truthful account? Is it the account that is sort of unsparing and full of the pain, or, you know, what does that leave out? Does that leave out stories of lightness and love and everything else? I mean, I'm wondering, like, are such concerns in the room with you when you sit down and write?
I think I'm abstractly aware of that, but that I know for certain that my project for myself is to try to think of traumatic things and of my story, really, and make them a funny story. Because, not just because that would be fun, but also it's only funny if you realize the person turned out okay. They're over it. They've transformed it. And because for me, what's often left out of queer fiction, or at least when I was a teenager in the, you know, it was like the 80s and 90s, was what I found was that always the tool was a defiant sense of joy. You know, we were out on the streets protesting the war, But the signs would say, you know, fishnets, not fighter jets, U.S. out of the war. We were funnier than they were. And that was our tool. We were always going to be funnier than the Defense Department. And we'd win the media. And that was like a revolution in protests. It's always been a sort of a tactic, and I think a really successful one. I'm not witty and cruel. I think that it could go that way. But I think just to say, like, it doesn't matter. Life's full of joy anyway. And I always felt that. And I wanted that to be in the book.
I mean, another tactic that's in the book is Arthur does think about and encounters all kinds of stories and stories of pain and stories of difficulty, especially as he's traveling. But it's not explicitly political. You don't identify, you don't sort of, for example, I mean, I think I was reading this somewhere, like we don't see like MAGA hats, you know, we don't see anything identified quite so literally and explicitly. Tell me about your decision to sort of not take that tack, which it could have been very easily, right? To go and lampoon certain people and make it very, very, you know, explicit. But you don't do that. Tell me about how you decided to handle this part of the story.
Well, I think two things. One, I think that's well covered. There's plenty of that. You know, I think the late night shows do already an excellent job, and there's of lampooning something terrifying that's happening in the country. But I think it's also a very personal thing, which is that I'm actually not good in the mode of anger or rant or rage. And so that comes through in the book, because there's books that you need, that you write for right now. Let's read it right now. It's about right now. And then there's books where I'm thinking, I hope you could read this 10 years from now and that it would still be relevant. And if I put something that's about right now, it will have changed already. I mean, just even writing the book, everything has changed under me. But I didn't have to change the book because I didn't nail it down.
There's a way that as I was reading this, I was like, this book is trying to prepare me for things. I had this funny feeling, and I was like, what is it preparing me for? And then there's that conversation between Arthur and the wife of his lover after his lover has died, his ex-lover long ago, you know, and they're talking about the death of the ex, and someone says, oh, you know, it's shocking. And Arthur goes, no, it's not shocking. I knew it was coming. I just didn't prepare myself properly, you know. And there's a sense of the way that you talk so much. I mean, you talk, but through Arthur, so many characters in this book keep talking about attention, pay attention, look at things, you know. Don't become blasé to beauty and to kindness. Tell me a little bit about about your relationship with the idea of attention, and then this book's preoccupation with attention as a certain kind of ethical position, as a moral imperative. Attention, no?
That's exactly what I think, and it's what I tell my students. If you want to be an artist of some kind, or even just an ethical person, it means being vulnerable to the world. But it also means being open to a place where you didn't see beauty or variety or specificity of. I mean, I read every graffiti in every bathroom I go to because it's just I read the name of the you know air freshener because it's just it makes it a real place I went to, not for a story of any kind, but just so that I'm actually in the world, and I see that humans were here before me and some person in a corporation chose the name Old Linen as their air freshener spray for some reason, and I just try to think about that person.
Arthur thinks a lot about, you think a lot about this person. You're there reading bathroom graffiti. You are awake to all the delights and absurdities of life. Arthur is thinking a little bit about his career, right? And Arthur's feeling a little bit about what does it mean to be at midlife, his position in the world, and he thinks a great deal about success. I mean, and it's a wonderful send-up of what it means to think about success, what it means to be a writer. And I'm wondering how you think about success and how, whether or not you're defining it differently, you know, having written about Arthur, having had the incredible success of Less and now of this book, has it changed for you how you define what it means to be a writerly success?
The response I got to Less, first of all, no one expected me to win that Pulitzer Prize. And then no one expected that to be a bestseller in the way it was. And having had five books before that, I know what's normal. I didn't come into it and be like, well, I'm a genius. I was like, I'm the same writer I was for five books.
Yeah, yeah.
And something different happened here that is definitely part chance. You know, that is chance. And so success can't be being lucky. Like that, that doesn't make any sense. Success has to be, this is a corny thing to say, reaching readers that you hadn't been able to reach before. That feels like success to me, because I know things go up and down. You know, I've seen it all. So if I'm defining success as the New York Times bestseller list, I'm setting myself up for a lot of problems. But if my success is that it reaches those other people, and I know also for every writer, there's the private success of having made the thing that was in your head. And if you can do that, the other things are not as important to you. You're like, well, I did my job. You know, the world either does their job or they don't.
Is this the end of the road for Arthur and you? Or is there another installment?
There's not immediately an installment, but I feel I have it's such a great voice for me to write in if I'm going through something that I can't find another way to get at it. But I'm not writing another Arthur Less novel at the moment. I can't imagine where he'd go now. Antarctica? Doesn't sound like a fun novel.
I don't think he has a lot of fun. I think it's...
That is true. It doesn't matter where he goes, I suppose.
he takes Arthur with himself everywhere he goes.
That's staff writer Paul Sagal talking with Andrew Sean Greer, author of the novel Less and its sequel, Less is Lost. Now we're going to wrap up the program with a little trip outdoors. The air is clear. It's just before dawn. And a writer named Ellen Bass, who's published a number of poems in The New Yorker, is taking her daily walk along the ocean near her home in Santa Cruz, California.
Westcliff Drive is a strange intersection of nature and city. So we have on the one side the whole of the Pacific. We've got beautiful cypress trees. And on the other side, we have just a regular road that people are driving up and down, and houses right up against it. We've still got some rosy-fingered dawn and a beautiful shining half moon. Oh, there's four seagulls just flying right across here. There's a surfer in the water and the whole of the Pacific. I've been walking here almost every day for about 30 years, and every day is a different day. The ocean is really wild sometimes, where it comes up over Westcliff Drive, so you can be walking along and have the spray hit you. Today it's pretty calm with just real nice, slow, perfect rollers crashing in. Oh, that surfer almost just got one here. The cliff here changes so fast. Even in terms of erosion, it's mudstone, which is layered, and as storms come and as the ocean keeps pounding into it, even just in the 30 years that I've been here, I've seen enormous change. They've had to actually move where the road is further in, because where the road was is now in the ocean. And that's so thrilling, really, to be able to live in geologic time. And right now, the sun is just peeking up above the hills down toward Monterey. We see it just coming up over the ridge. I was thinking that most people love, or say they love, variety and new things, and I think our culture does act like that. We always want something new and different and better. But my family and close friends tease me a lot about how much I love repetition and how much I love to just do the same thing over and over in a kind of mule-like way. And the first thing I thought about was this walk that I take every day on Westcliff Drive. And so I wrote this poem, Ode to Repetition. I like to take the same walk down the wide expanse of Woodrow to the ocean. And most days I turn left toward the lighthouse. The sea is always different. Some days dreamy, waves hardly waves, just a broad undulation in no hurry to arrive. Other days the surf's drunk, crashing into the cliffs like a car wreck. And when I get home, I like the same dishes stacked in the same cupboards, and then unstacked, and then stacked again. And the rhododendron, spring after spring, blossoming its pink ceremony. I could dwell in the kingdom of Coltrane, those rivers of breath through his horn, as he forms each phrase of lush life over and over until I die. Once I was afraid of this, opening the curtains every morning, only to close them again each night. You could despair in the fixed town of your own life. But when I wake up to pee, I'm grateful the toilet's in its usual place, the sink with its gift of water. I look out at the street, the halos of lampposts in the fog, or the moon rinsing the parked cars. When I get back in bed, I find the woman who's been sleeping there each night for 30 years. Only she's not the same. Her body more naked in its aging, its disorder, though I still come to her like a beggar. One morning, one of us will rise bewildered without the other and open the curtains. There will be the same shaggy redwood in the neighbor's yard and the faultless stars going out one by one into the day.
Ellen Bass read her poem Ode to Repetition, which appears in the collection Like a Beggar. You can read more of her work at newyorker.com. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks so much. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofenin Putubwele,
along with Jeffrey Masters, Will Coley, Jenny Lawton, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Joe Plord, Harrison Keithline, and James Napoli.
And special thanks to Kat Campion, Maureen Russell, and Danny St. Germain.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.